A pleasant Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to KUAF 91.3, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021. On our show this afternoon, flu numbers in Arkansas are relatively low this season. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich will help explain why. We also have the latest from Governor Asa Hutchinson regarding COVID-19 cases and vaccinations. And in our second half hour, we go way back in University of Arkansas history, before there were even any buildings or students, our continued observance of 150 years of the U of A later. After we wrap up our show, stay with KUAF for Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today, sexual harassment allegations against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo have prompted an investigation of his conduct, and they've renewed attention on the Me Too movement. A discussion about where we are right now with Me Too, and answers to some of your questions about the coronavirus vaccines, including the new one from Johnson & Johnson. Here and Now begins at 1. There are 225 new cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas after the most recent day of testing by the Arkansas Department of Health. The ADH is adding 4 deaths to the state's totals. Hospitalizations dropped by 25 in the last 24 hours. Active cases ticked up by 12. Governor Asa Hutchinson says more than 62% of the more than 975,000 vaccines the state has been given have been administered. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear from the governor about an expansion of who is eligible for vaccinations in Arkansas. Hospitals in Northwest Arkansas are reporting 26 patients in COVID-19 units today. This is the 6th consecutive week the average number of COVID patients in Benton and Washington County hospitals has dropped. Last week, hospitals in the region averaged a combined 35 virus patients, the highest average in mid-January, 128 patients. The Oklahoma State Department of Health continues to add deaths from the virus that occurred in the past few months to that state's total. Yesterday, 56 additional deaths were added, some of them occurring as far back as November 13th. The Oklahoma total deaths from COVID-19 now registering 4,534. There were 111 new cases diagnosed in Oklahoma yesterday. A final vote by Arkansas lawmakers on Senate Bill 6 is expected this week. The bill, which would establish an almost total ban on abortions, advanced out of the House Public Health, Welfare, and Labor Committee yesterday. The bill has already been approved by the full Senate and would only need to be approved by the House to be sent to the governor's desk. Washington County Justice of the Peace Judith Yanez is resigning. She represents District 4. She told a local TV station she made the decision because the makeup of the court has made healthy debate impossible and other justices of the peace are not interested in addressing community needs. It's likely Governor Asa Hutchinson will fill the seat once it's officially declared open. And we have more news from the Washington County Quorum Court later on the show as the body debates how ordinances may be brought up for consideration. That's in today's second half hour. Arkansas's sales tax collections are up again in the February report. The Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration says the gains are about 15% when compared year to year. And the fiscal year-to-date collections are nearly $5 billion, an increase of 8.4% compared to the same time frame last year. Northwest Medical Center in Bentonville is hosting a blood drive until 4 today in the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks Bloodmobile, which is parked in the hospital's lot at 3000 Medical Center Parkway in Bentonville. CBCO is the sole supplier of blood and plasma to patients at more than 40 area hospitals. CBCO says there is an urgent need for all blood types. Make it 10 consecutive conference wins for the Arkansas men's basketball team. The Razorbacks defeated South Carolina last night 101-73 in Columbia. The win, the 20th overall, means Arkansas has clinched the number 2 seed at next week's SEC tournament. Fans of spring-like weather on a winning streak, too. More sunshine expected tomorrow with highs near 70. As for tonight, clear, lows in the upper 30s. And a final reminder that you can join Randy Dixon and me for a live visual version of our Pryor Center profiles tonight at 6. Randy, with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, will share archives from Arkansas history as part of the program Arkansas News History, exploring the KATV collection. It's live. It begins at 6 tonight, and you can register for free at pryorcenter.uark.edu. This is Ozarks at Large. Seasonal influenza cases are minimal this year. Experts say that's likely due to protective pandemic practices. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Last influenza season, which began autumn of 2019, ending spring 2020, was the second worst on recent state record. But this year?
Well, the incidence in Arkansas is very low. We do not have many cases of influenza around the state.
Dr. Jennifer Dillahay is state epidemiologist and medical director for immunization and outbreak response at the Arkansas Department of Health.
And that's good news for us because we certainly don't want a lot of influenza on top of the COVID-19 that we've had.
Which number well over 300,000 cases. More than 5,400 Arkansans have died from COVID-19. Since last September, however, only 1,600 positive influenza cases have been reported to the Arkansas Department of Health online database by healthcare providers.
We have had people with the flu around the state, and we have had some deaths. We've had 15 people die this flu season as a result of influenza.
Far lower compared to last flu season, which resulted in 118 deaths. Flu activity nationwide is also reportedly low. The unusually low flu incidence may be due to non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs, such as masking and social distancing measures Arkansans are taking to prevent contracting and spreading COVID-19.
I would say that's a very reasonable understanding of why we're having low rates of influenza right now. COVID-19 and influenza are spread the same way with respiratory droplets. So wearing a mask and maintaining a distance from others and avoiding crowds and washing your hands often, those are excellent measures to practice to prevent the spread of influenza. And so maybe after we're on the other side of the pandemic, we might want to consider maintaining some of these practices whenever we have a flu season.
Which the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is suggesting. But this year, Dillahay says some Arkansans are catching both the flu and COVID at the same time.
Yes, I have seen reports of people having both, which is, I'm sure, a very difficult situation for those patients. I have not tallied the numbers, but I have seen reports and know that that has occurred.
Influenza is caused by a virus similar to how COVID-19 is spread, mainly through respiratory droplets.
When people cough or sneeze, or when they touch a doorknob that's contaminated and they then touch their mouth or nose, then they can pick up the virus. And people can spread it before they have symptoms, a day or two before. And that's similar also to COVID-19.
Both COVID and the flu virus can affect the lungs, which in the case of influenza can lead to bacterial pneumonia and even heart failure. Prior to COVID, the typical flu season would yield between 25 to 50 million infections nationwide, more than 200,000 people hospitalized with over 23,000 deaths. A graph spanning 2005 to last year shows the worst year by far on record in Arkansas for flu was the 2017 season when 227 Arkansans died. But CDC is warning that this year's slow flu season could lead to a more virulent season next year.
So we see a high number of deaths in one year and then a low number the next year and so forth. And they tend to alternate every year or every 2 years. So it would not surprise me if this next year, because not many people were exposed to flu this year, that they would be vulnerable for flu next year.
Scientists develop flu vaccines for upcoming flu seasons based on current circulating strains. But sampling for next year's vaccines may be constrained, experts say, due to far fewer flu cases across the U.S. Plus, lower flu infection 1 year can affect natural immunity the next. Which raises the question, given we have seasonal influenza, should we expect seasonal COVID-19 once the pandemic is over?
The scientific articles I've been reading, many of them postulate that we will COVID-19 will become what we call endemic, that it's like flu and something that's around and on an ongoing basis. And if that is the case, the question will be, does it have a seasonality like the flu? Well, it may, but we don't know yet.
So best to mask, distance, and wash your hands, vaccinated or not, until further notice. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. As we near the one-year anniversary of the pandemic arriving in Arkansas, more Arkansans are becoming eligible for vaccinations. Yesterday, Governor Asa Hutchinson expanded the current phase of the state's vaccinations, Phase 1B, to include food manufacturing workers.
And the food manufacturing workers includes meat processing and grain, oilseed milling. This is estimated to be 49,000 Arkansans in these groups. This will be from poultry processors to meat processors to grain processors.
The governor made the announcement during yesterday's weekly briefing regarding COVID-19 in the state. He says the time was right to include all workers at such plants.
We look back on the history of our cases and where we had early spikes in cases, breakouts, as well as deaths, and we had a real jeopardy with those that were in the food processing industry. And so, again, we wanted to move them in there first because they work, all of those that are in the category that I identified of agriculture, food manufacturing, they work close in proximity to each other. And so that was the reason that they're on the front line. They're obviously an essential worker, but in addition, they're an exposed worker because of that, and we wanted to move them in.
The inclusion of food manufacturing workers comes after last month's inclusion of people between the ages of 65 and 70. Still not eligible for shots, though, are restaurant workers, even though many of the previous health directives, now guidelines, come into play at restaurants and bars. Governor Hutchinson says the state is not yet prepared to administer vaccines to restaurant workers.
So they're in 1C, so hopefully we'll get to them soon. We recognize that they need vaccinations as well, but that's a category that the CDC guidelines have recommended them to be in.
The governor says he thinks the state is closing in on its goal to finish the 1B vaccinations by the end of this month, and that includes the recent expansion of the category. After the governor's briefing yesterday, President Joe Biden announced the federal government expects to have all adults wanting a shot vaccinated by the end of May. Arkansas is expecting to receive an additional 2,500 to 3,000 Moderna and Pfizer vaccines weekly, and the just-approved Johnson & Johnson vaccines are coming as well. He says the state is expecting about 24,000 of those vaccines.
And that J&J vaccine is what's going to give us an extra margin that we can move in and start with our poultry workers and our other food manufacturing workers that have been identified.
For the first time, there is a confirmed case of a COVID-19 variant in Arkansas, a single case of the UK variant. Because of HIPAA rules, no more information about that case is being shared. Dr. Jose Romero, the state's Secretary of Health, says this is not an unexpected development.
This is not something that we did not expect. I'm surprised that we hadn't found it earlier. It simply reminds us that we need to use the mask, regardless of whether it's a mandated issue or not. We need to keep these masks and use them. And it also reinforces the need to immunize. Without immunization, we won't be able to protect against these variants. So again, the vaccines that we currently have available are effective against the UK variant.
And Governor Hutchinson says there will be a new effort to make vaccines more available in rural parts of the state. The Arkansas Department of Health will be designating specific locations in each of the state's public health regions for vaccine distribution.
These clinics will be set up and held each week in counties with low vaccination rates, and it'll be initially on a first-come, first-serve basis, but we envision having next week a statewide toll-free number that can be called to help identify where they can go for these vaccine clinics. We'll provide more information to you next week on that. And those locations will be provided in on our Department of Health website when they're specifically identified.
For the first week of these rural clinics, the county in the Northwest Public Health Sector in Arkansas scheduled to have a vaccination clinic is Conway County, where Morrilton is the county seat. The full briefing can be watched at the governor's YouTube channel. Arkansas's first net-zero new construction multi-use building is going up in Fayetteville as we speak. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us more about the project and what it says about the state of the solar energy market in Arkansas.
After outgrowing several other office spaces since 2012, Integrity Partners is building its Northwest Arkansas headquarters at the corner of South Street and School Avenue, across the street from the new Fayetteville Public Library expansion. Regional Director John Coleman says the project is meant to make a statement.
The net zero means that we generate as much or more energy through our solar panels that'll be on the building, the solar modules, than what the building consumes. Early on, we had defined what that rooftop footprint was going to be and how much solar we could have. And then we were able to work backwards from that and really determine whether we thought this was a viable opportunity or not.
Coleman says they're also incorporating energy-efficient design, which has generally fallen by the wayside with the advent of air conditioning.
We look at really passive design strategies like large overhangs on south-facing windows, designing in to minimize your western-facing exposure where possible, and then even being really diligent in the way that we air seal the building so to minimize leakage, being really smart about our installation strategies.
Integrity mainly operates in two sectors, energy efficiency and renewable energy projects, and sustainability consulting for new construction. Coleman says they're applying all that expertise in the creation of the company's new space.
To try to do something that we really haven't seen in the market very much, and if you do see it, it's typically on the coasts and not in the central part of the country where we pay, really inexpensive electricity rates. So our goal is to do this and make it economically feasible, and we think we're going to achieve that.
Coleman says Integrity's other goal is to demonstrate that net zero construction can be achieved without having to charge twice the typical rent afterwards.
So on the ground floor, we've got 5,700 square feet of office space. 4,000 square feet will be for our office at Integrity Partners, and then we're going to lease out the other 1,700 square feet or so. So another small office space, kind of companion office. And then we have 28 residential units.
All the units in the three-story building will be one bedroom, ranging from 500 to 900 square feet, with rates between $900 and $1,300 a month, which is comparable to existing rates in downtown Fayetteville.
We operate in Arkansas, but we also work in a lot of surrounding states. And then we've got projects all over the country, too. And so we feel like this is one that's going to set a really good example that could be replicated in other parts of the country.
Coleman says reducing the carbon footprint to address climate change becomes a lot more appealing when it makes economic sense, which wasn't necessarily the case just a few years ago.
And we're at this really interesting point where, these technologies make economic sense. It saves money, and we're able to accomplish that at the same time. And for a long time, it hasn't been that way. But because the cost of solar has come down so much, because the cost of some of these other technologies has come down, and then coupling it with some of the smart design strategies, like what I talked about before, we're able to do this. And we need to do more of it.
The cost of solar energy has dropped dramatically. And in this instance, Coleman says Integrity will also be able to stretch it out over the term of financing, which makes it even more affordable.
So we're going to be generating energy at 2.5 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas typically, you would be paying 7 to 7.5 cents a kilowatt hour now. So it's very favorable in that way.
Battery storage has also come a long way, both in terms of technology and affordability. And Coleman says state-level policies have encouraged growth in the solar market as well, especially legislation like the Solar Access Act, passed in 2019, which allows low-income residents, nonprofits, churches, and schools to lease solar equipment from a third party.
Basically, what it does is it allows companies like us to go out and build solar projects. We invest all the capital dollars, and then we enter into an agreement to sell them solar.
Coleman says Integrity is currently working on 60 megawatts worth of solar energy projects across the state, which include partnerships with several school districts like Fayetteville, Boonville, Green Forest, and Hope.
Smaller communities throughout the state that are seeing the same benefits and moving in that direction as well. And that's when you know that the market is really there.
Construction of Integrity's net zero building in Fayetteville is scheduled for completion in July. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
Integrity's main headquarters in Little Rock, also a net zero building. The difference there is that the company's made renovations to the existing structure to achieve that goal.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
The Women's Foundation of Arkansas has released a multimedia report of a new study exploring the opportunities, barriers, and resource gaps for Arkansas's women of color business owners. WFA commissioned the study in partnership with the University of Central Arkansas to build on its previous research, identifying entrepreneurship as a key driver of women's economic mobility in Arkansas, especially among Black women. To learn more about the study, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Anna Beth Gorman, Executive Director of the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, and Christy Carter, Director of Marketing for the Division of Outreach and Community Engagement at UCA, and a founding member of the university's Minority Vendor Partnership Initiative. Carter, who is the principal investigator on the study, says the primary goal of the new report was to amplify the voices of women of color.
That's definitely, I guess, the primary goal of the report. But we also wanted to look so at the entrepreneurial ecosystem and those support organizations within that ecosystem and what services and gaps needed to be filled.
So for this report, to find that information, you had 6 virtual focus groups with 44 women of color. You also had 108 surveys from additional participants. The report is interactive, which I really liked because there's 7 women highlighted in videos, and it was so fun, like, being able to hear it from them. So in this report, looking at those barriers, you found that access to capital was the number one barrier, which follows past research that entrepreneurs of color start their businesses with almost 3 times less in overall capital compared to their white counterparts. So we've got capital as an issue, but what were some of the other barriers that participants mentioned?
The really interesting one that popped out, were financial services, and that's really those relationships with accounting services, not just your banks, but, you know, professional services firm. And that is, I mean, truly something that the white community business community takes for granted, right? You know, and again, because if you like, who are accountants? You know, where are they working? And in a small business, you understanding the nuance of what a small business is. We're talking about very small businesses, right? Sole proprietorships or individuals. So to take that extra step of having that professional service relationship, that's an additional investment that you need, but it is one of the things that's critical to business growth. And so, and in a pandemic year, individuals, businesses that didn't have those relationships, those are who missed out on federal funding, because it was accountants and bankers that walked their clients through the process, that handheld clients through the process. And so I'd like Christy to speak to this, but when she's talking about those gaps, I mean, we're talking about schisms, like huge, you know, just really worlds of difference here.
We look at the data, and you hit it spot on, because you've looked at it, and so you know that the access to capital is the number one barrier, and the barriers underneath the access to capital, you know, or that follow them, are all really these tangible problems or barriers that can be solved. But the one thing that the barrier that came out of this study that surprised me as the PI or the principal investigator was the whole racial bias and discrimination piece of it, specifically the perceived legitimacy part of it. In those focus groups, hearing the women's stories about how they were afraid to put their faces, their black faces or colorful faces in front of their brand, you know, and their natural hair to represent their brand, because they were afraid of being illegitimate or not being seen as worthy to be patronized by specific consumers. It became an issue. As the lead investigator on the study, I had to look a little bit deeper into what perceived legitimacy was all about and to go into the literature about patronage among women of color business owners and entrepreneurs and how that all plays out. So it's really complicated. You know, again, like I said, credit worthiness and accounting and financial management, even an adequate credit score are all things that these women, if they work on them and they know where the resources are to help them, that can change. But it's hard to change someone's mind about you when, you know, they have a set of ideas about a specific group of people that makes them illegitimate and unworthy of being patronized. So how do you contend with that as a woman of color? So that was the biggest barrier, you know, because, again, that's one that it's more difficult to get around. And in the report, you'll read, you know, some of their actual quotes. Those quotes came from the women themselves. And, you know, what's a go around to, you know, to perceive legitimacy? That's another really big conversation. And I want to kind of impress upon anyone who would listen to this, if they're part of the entrepreneurial support organizations that, you know, put out the programs and services to help entrepreneurs, that they're not the problem. They're actually the solution to this and part of the solution to this.
Well, I'm glad you brought up those resources. Something I found fascinating about this study is that 49% of your participants said that they received support from informal networks, and they were neither the respondents were saying that they were neither satisfied nor dissatisfied with support services because they didn't even know they existed. Mm-hmm. So how do you close that gap? Like, whose job is it to educate? Are these organizations not doing a good enough job of reaching out to these women of color? Do these women of color just not know where to look? Because someone in the report said a really nice thing about how she didn't know where to look because she didn't have that generational knowledge being passed down to her.
This is an area that I believe Christy and I are really passionate about. The next steps from or takeaways from this report is addressing the ecosystem and addressing informal versus formal. And for women business owners, women of color business owners, this isn't true generally speaking across the whole state, but in some of the counties that we're talking about, we're talking about impoverished counties, low-income counties, we're talking about, you know, marginalized communities. A lot of these businesses operate in a term I've just started using, the gray economy, right? They're not in the mainstream economy. You know, no matter where you are in the state, you know where your major thoroughfares are in your city, right? Like, that's where the big grocery store is. That's where you do, you know, your everyday stuff. But like in your communities, like where actually you live, like these little specialty stores, so, or sole proprietorships or small, you know, cottage industry style businesses. That's a lot of like the women that we're talking about, right? In this informal space. And they're operating again in the gray economy. Okay. So they've bootstrapped themselves. They've poured their personal finances into their businesses. Conversely, on the mainstream economy, a seasoned business person, they're not going to take from their retirement. They're going to go walk into a bank and get a loan to invest in a business or scale up a business. So, but because we're talking about apples and oranges, we have to start with what we have, right? And so I think it's been so interesting to learn more about the informal networks that exist. And Christie's report, we really got to know a group out of Jonesboro. It's called Over a Cup, and it's this great, this entrepreneurial support. It's a group of women, predominantly, Christie, correct me if I'm wrong, Black women, business owners, and they meet once a Saturday, and they talk about various different things, and they give each other support, and they recommend try this, try that. But that's just one example in Eastern Arkansas. 2 weeks ago, through Christie's kind of promoting this, she met and has now connected me to an informal group out of Northwest Arkansas. Christie, the name of it, it's Irma's group. We just visited with them.
Conexión de Negocios Latinos.
Okay, so it's for the Hispanic business community. You know, and Irma recognized a gap in Northwest Arkansas because she was attending all the networking events, all the chamber events, and she wasn't seeing folks that looked like her at these events. And so she has created an informal ESO entrepreneurial support space, right? And so she and I just had the opportunity to meet late last week, and we talked about, you know, how the Small Business Administration is really trying to push right now to get small minority-owned businesses into this second round of PPP. They've lowered a lot of restrictions. Right now, it's focused really on identifying women and minorities to get them in. You know, and she pointed out, are there any of these webinars, though, in Spanish? And so it took me 2 phone calls to find the state agency that had the one webinar in Spanish, you know, but to get that to Irma. So it's like we have to bridge from the gray to the mainstream without undervaluing what's happening in our gray economy. Businesses are thriving. I mean, communities are moving forward and they're doing, but, you know, again, when we want to create generational wealth and we want to really address gender and racial wealth gaps, we want to see the gray economy become more of the mainstream economy. And that's where you see this transformational wealth happen, the generational wealth happen. And so that's important. But that connection between informal and formal groups, it's going to be really critical.
You know, it's difficult to have these conversations about race and anything that deals with racism or system issues. So one big thing about this particular report that shed a light on all of it is just the knowledge gap, period. Closing the knowledge gap for all entrepreneurs and everyone and all the actors within the entrepreneurial ecosystem is imperative, I think, for our state to thrive even more so. So knowledge, in my opinion, has no color, right? It's, you know, knowledge should be open for everyone. And this is really a great opportunity for our state to come together collectively, all the folks and ESOs involved that have the means to come together and let's figure out how we can truly map the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Arkansas. And that's really where Annabeth and I met. I was actually pitching the entrepreneurial ecosystem mapping at the Asset Funders Network event, and it was back in 2019. And I'm out here talking about mapping the entrepreneurial ecosystem for Arkansas so that we can come together to create a structure like some of the other states have done and major cities have done, where we go out, find out where are those resources and put them in one place. Maybe it's online where everyone can access it. And so we know what services we have out there and things aren't so disjointed because now we know who's offering what. And that's hard to do, you know. It's something that's hard to do, but it's not impossible. We have definitely have benchmarked programs across the nation, and we have friends in other places who have done this. So Arkansas can do the same thing. And I'm hoping, you know, as a PI and an ecosystem builder, that what we end up seeing is we start pulling all of our resources together to make that a reality so that we're not all fumbling around trying to figure out where the information is and to kind of help close that knowledge gap.
So this report is so critical in our next phase of work. From the highlights of the report, we are going to be working on what we call a regional economic mobility hub, and it's going to be focusing on women of color business owners, and it is intentionally to address gender and racial wealth gaps in our state. And we hope to tackle all the items that we've talked about today, but the knowledge gap that we want to address is the knowledge gap for the organizations that aren't stepping up to the plate to do what they need to do for the women business owners. It's not the women's knowledge gap. We can learn from this report. It is raising awareness amongst the agencies that we went to. You know, the Small Business Administration saw this report. They recognize, okay, you know, we need to do more and what can we do? And so they're working with us to launch some webinars in the next couple of weeks designed for PPP, but really addressing a female perspective, like getting rid of jargon, getting rid of words that are insider terminology, just like tell it to me straight. Am I eligible? What do I need? Who do I call? How do I get it forgiven? You know, I'm a busy woman. I don't have time for all this. Like, I just need to know those things really, really quickly. And so again, I think what we're really hopeful about is that, you know, women business owners can share with us more about their perspective, and we can address our knowledge gap on the other side and really bridge, you know, the gray and the mainstream economies together.
That was Annabeth Gorman, Executive Director of the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, and Principal Investigator Christy Carter. They spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this week. The full report is available at womensfoundationarkansas.org. It was 150 years ago this month, the University of Arkansas became reality on paper. The first students would take classes just a little bit later. To celebrate the sesquicentennial, Charlie Allison, the executive editor for University Relations at the U of A, is delivering snapshots of the university's past. This week, we go way back.
Joseph Carter Corbin, the son of former slaves, was elected to be the Arkansas Superintendent of Education in 1873. And as a result, he also became the ex officio president of the University of Arkansas Board of Trustees. As part of that role, he signed the contract for construction of the first permanent building on campus, the building we know today as Old Main. Corbin was the son of Susan and William Corbin, former slaves who moved to Ohio by the 1820s after being freed. Their son Joseph was born at Chillicothe, Ohio in 1833, so nearly 190 years ago. He was the eldest of 12 children. Perhaps it was given that he would become an educator. He attended schools in Chillicothe and was a classmate of John Mercer Langston, the future abolitionist, educator, and politician. And the two of them followed similar paths in life. At age 15, Corbin moved to Louisville, Kentucky to teach. But he moved back to Ohio after a couple years to pursue a college degree at Ohio University. He was only the third black student to earn a bachelor's degree at Ohio University, finishing in 1853, and then earning a master's degree in 1856. Soon after that, he moved back to Louisville, where he worked in mercantile and banking during the day, while also serving surreptitiously as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, helping slaves from the South escape to the safety of the North. Amid the Civil War, Corbin moved to Cincinnati, where he edited and wrote for a newspaper called The Colored Citizen. After the war, it's not sure what brought him to Arkansas, but he moved to Little Rock and took a job in 1872 as a reporter for the Arkansas Republican newspaper. This was the Reconstruction period, and the Republican Party was still ascendant at the time. Corbin ran for the office of State Superintendent of Education. He ran against the white incumbent, Thomas Smith, who was also a Republican. And like Corbin, Smith had also come to Arkansas from Cincinnati, Ohio. Smith, however, had arrived in Little Rock during the latter part of the Civil War. He came as a surgeon in the Union Army and then stayed in Arkansas after the war. Smith had been elected superintendent of education in 1868, and he made the first efforts at establishing public schools in the state. In 1872, he was running for re-election on what was known as the Reform Republican ticket. Corbin, on the other hand, ran on the regular Republican ticket. It was one of many contests that illustrated a split among the Republicans, a split that would grow wider over the next 2 years. Corbin won the race and took office on January 4, 1873. Very early in his role as president of the university's Board of Trustees, Corbin proposed to create a normal branch of the university for the instruction of black teachers. The term normal was used in those days to refer to a college or school that trained students in the pedagogy of education, how to be a teacher. Across the state, well-trained teachers were desperately needed to fill new public schools. The Fayetteville campus had started filling that need with a normal department for white teachers, and Corbin's proposal would put the wheels in motion to create a normal college for black teachers. In March, the Board of Trustees appointed a committee to develop legislation to establish a branch normal college. By April, the state legislature had approved this branch of the university, authorizing its location to be set somewhere south or east of Little Rock, and approving the use of up to $25,000 for its creation. Meanwhile, here at the Fayetteville campus, plans moved forward for a new permanent building on campus. Construction bids were taken, reviewed by the trustees. During the summer of 1873, as president of the board, Corbin signed a $123,000 contract with the Oliver and Mays firm for construction of the university's first permanent building. It was finished 2 years later and is, as I said earlier, the building we now know as Old Main. Unfortunately, a year later, Corbin lost his race for re-election as the rupture in the Republican Party allowed the Democratic Party to regain power in the state. To make ends meet, he took a job teaching mathematics for about a year at the Lincoln Institute in Jefferson City, Missouri. But he returned to Arkansas in 1875 and was appointed the first principal of the new Branch Normal College in Pine Bluff. That's the institution we know today as the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. For the next 27 years, Corbin threw his life into educating the future black teachers of Arkansas, growing the size of the college, increasing the faculty ranks slowly, and advocating for equity in the state's separate and sorely disparate educational system. And what an educator to have leading that charge. Corbin was best known for his proficiency in mathematics, having written numerous articles for a variety of mathematical and educational publications, but he was also described as conversant and well-read in eight languages, from ancient Greek and Latin to the completely unexpected Hebrew and Danish. He also appears to have been a good musician and taught piano, organ, and flute at the Branch Normal College. In 1890, expansion of the Morrill Land-Grant Act allowed the Branch Normal College to become the second land-grant institution in Arkansas. In keeping with that designation, Corbin planned to expand the college's curriculum. He wanted to include vocational and industrial programs of study, and he called on the state legislature for the equitable division of state appropriations between the Fayetteville campus and the Pine Bluff campus. His calls helped improve Branch Normal's appropriations, but they never came near equity in budget, faculty, or facilities. During the rest of the decade, Corbin came into greater conflict, first with the state legislature, and probably because of a change in the governor's office, and then with the Board of Trustees, who, of course, were appointed by the governor. Despite this turbulence, he organized an association called the Teachers of Negro Children and served as its first president. It was later renamed the Arkansas Teachers Association. And much later, it merged with the Arkansas Educational Association after integration of the state schools in the 1960s. In 1902, the Board of Trustees dismissed Corbin from the college that he had founded. He became a principal at Pine Bluff's Merrill High School and taught for another 6 years. He died in 1911. Today, it's easy for us at the Fayetteville campus to celebrate the significant step that Joseph Carter Corbin ushered in, the construction of a building that has become a symbol of higher education in Arkansas, a building that is beloved among students and alumni at the U of A. But Old Main, well, that's a story for another day. For today, don't forget to celebrate Joseph Carter Corbin's greater achievement, the establishment of the first historically black institution of higher education in Arkansas, a place where dreams of careers and advancement and a brighter future become reality, a university in Pine Bluff that continues to serve the people of Arkansas in radically uplifting ways.
Charlie Allison, executive editor for University Relations at the University of Arkansas, gives us profiles in the U of A's history each week as the university marks 150 years of service. There are many other commemorations taking place and scheduled. To find out more, go to 150.uark.edu. That's the number 150.uark.edu.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today, speaking with Liz Atwell with the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. Liz, it's always cool to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Here we are, the beginning of March. I bet things are things starting to bud out there at BGO?
Yes. It's always an exciting time of year when March rolls around, because we are starting to see, you know, things popping up out of the ground, and, you know, we really start to feel, okay, spring is so close. And it's just so fun to watch and neat to see things coming back alive again after, you know, the long winter.
And of course, when those things start peeking out of the ground and blooming, you guys need help from our community. Y'all rely on volunteer help quite a bit.
Absolutely. A lot of folks don't realize we are a nonprofit organization. We have a very small staff. And so we rely very heavily on volunteers to do everything.
Coming up in March, two different dates that y'all are hosting kind of a volunteer fair. Talk about what's going to be taking place. Two dates again. That's March 16th and the 20th.
That's correct. So, yeah, we are looking for new volunteers to get involved out here at the garden. We have lots of, we're very excited this year. 2021, we're hoping will be a little bit better than 2020, and we're going to need some help with those things. And so we are having a new volunteer orientation at the garden on those dates from 11 to noon. And interested volunteers only need to attend one of those sessions, so whichever is most convenient. And we are going to have limited seating, and everything will be COVID compliant, but there's no need to register. We just hope, if you're interested in helping out at the garden, that you come out and find a way to get involved. We have lots of areas that people can get plugged into. Our admissions office, you can get out in the garden and get your hands dirty with our horticulture team. We have, of course, events. We have lots of education programs. So there's really something for everyone.
I was about to ask you, you know, do I need to have a green thumb to be able to do something out there? And not so much, huh?
No, not at all. You know, if growing plants is not your thing, there's lots of other areas to get involved. We have a lot of wonderful retired teachers who help with our education program. So if you enjoy working with kids or teaching, that's a great way to get involved. And then we have, you know, lots of events. So there's, if you're interested in like more hospitality type things, greeting guests, helping people find where they need to go, that sort of thing. There's opportunities there as well.
Liz Atwell with the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. Again, those volunteer information dates, March 16th and the 20th, 11 a.m. to noon. You only need to attend one to find out what's going on at BGO.
All of our information you can find at bgozarks.org, but we are also on Facebook as well. And yeah, we're open. Right now we are closed currently on Wednesdays and Thursdays, but we're open Friday through Tuesday from 9 to 5.
Liz Atwell with the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. Hope it's a great spring for y'all.
Thank you so much, Pete.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF, local matters.
This is Ozarks at Large. An ordinance that places limitations on how justices of the peace can bring items before the quorum court is heading to the full Washington County Quorum Court after it passed through the County Services Committee Monday evening. The ordinance, which was sponsored by Justice of the Peace Jim Wilson, requires all proposed ordinances to go through a committee before being placed on the agenda for consideration by the full court. It also prohibits proposed ordinances from being raised a second time within a year if an ordinance was voted down the first time around. Justice of the Peace Lisa Ecke spoke in favor of the ordinance, saying requiring ordinances to go through committees first creates more time for discussion and fine-tuning before those ordinances show up on the agenda for the full quorum court. Other JPs don't see it that way. Justice of the Peace Suki Heyer says the proposal is unnecessary.
I'll just start off with my questions. I'd like to know why this is needed. Why is this change needed? Having trouble understanding why we need to have this, why we had an entire meeting about this one ordinance. I'd also like to ask the county attorney, if is the prohibition on bringing back an ordinance within a year, is this constitutional? I'm not really sure on that point.
Following Monday's committee meeting, County Attorney Brian Lester told us an ordinance is presumed constitutional and the burden of providing otherwise rests with the challenging party. Justice of the Peace Eva Madison also spoke against the ordinance. Like Hires, Madison is one of the five Democrats serving on the quorum court. The other 10 JPs are Republicans. Madison says the ordinance is an attempt to silence the minority.
I brought an ordinance forth to the court, and it basically, y'all didn't like it. So you're trying to prevent the minority party from ever having any voice. You're going to take everything to a committee where you have the majority strategically designed to silence us. We were all elected just as you were, and it is not fair. And I think you should think about the day that the tables are turned, if that's the way you would want to be treated.
Madison is referring to an ordinance she drafted that sets out how the county should spend about $4.5 million in federal CARES Act funding. That proposal was introduced in the February quorum court meeting and remains on the agenda after failing to get enough votes to pass. Madison says the ordinance to limit how proposals are brought to the court is obstructionist.
And it's very disturbing, and I do not believe this ordinance is constitutional. And I think that all this is going to do is buy this county an expensive lawsuit.
Justices of the Peace Robert Dennis and Jim Wilson voted in favor of advancing the ordinance. Suki Hires and Evelyn Rio Stafford voted against it. Sean Simmons and Butch Pond abstained, and County Services Committee Chair Sam Duncan cast the deciding vote to send the proposal for consideration by the full quorum court, which will have its regular meeting on March 18th at 6 p.m. When Rio Stafford attempted to table the proposal until April, Duncan declined to recognize her and instead called for the vote.
This is KUAF. I'm Timothy Dennis. We're all coming up on an anniversary that nobody wants to celebrate. On or around March 13th of 2020, everyone's world changed. Everybody's. And the year since has been a challenge, to say the least. One thing that has hit me personally is the fact that there haven't been many opportunities to see live music in the past year. And you know what? Listening to the same old albums, it just doesn't cut it sometimes. But we'd like to hear from you, in your own words. How has a full year of masks, social distancing, and just the unknown affected you? Call the KUAF Connects line at 479-575-6577 and let us know. Again, that number is 479-575-6577.
And this is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and St. Paul. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to our Wednesday edition of the show included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, who delivered news and sound about the Washington County Quorum Court, and Charlie Allison. Timothy Dennis produced today's show next door in the Harold and Blanche Koch News Studio. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl is still performing live many afternoons around 4 o'clock our time on the Daryl Sean Facebook and Instagram feeds. You can go online and subscribe to our absolutely free podcast version of our daily show. Just go to any of the major podcast distributors, sign up for free, and you'll be able to listen to the show on your schedule. You can also ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent edition of our daily show. Speaking of daily shows, we've got another one for you tomorrow at noon and 7, right here on 91.3 KUAF. Finally, you can find out much more about the show and find past shows at OzarksAtLarge.com. Thanks so much for being with us on this beautiful Wednesday. We're back again tomorrow. I'm Kyle Kellums. Take care of yourself, please.